This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. Coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Louis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village.
On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm thrilled to share with you the opening proceedings of our current conference, which is running online. We had a session yesterday, the Friday before November 5th, and we have our last session on this Friday, the 19th of November. The title of the conference is Where Do We Go From Here? Revisiting Black-Irish Relations and Responding to a Transnational Moment. And to open the conference, we had the pleasure and honour of hosting opening remarks from An Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, TD, who opened the conference from Ireland, and the NYU Provost, Catherine Fleming, also made some opening remarks. The first lecture was delivered by Professor Jane Allmeyer. Jane is an esteemed early modern historian based at Trinity College Dublin, a really high profile researcher, publisher, and general change agent in education in Ireland and beyond. And she talked about Blackness and Irishness in the early modern period, which was a really wonderful way to contextualize the conference and open things up. So I'm thrilled to be able to share this with you today on This Irish American Life. She uses a lot of images in her presentation, but I think that even without you being able to see the images on radio, it's a powerful presentation and actually works just with audio. So I've decided to go ahead and share this with you today. I encourage you to engage with the rest of the programming. The last day is next Friday, and we'll continue to share some of this programming on This Irish American Life. And if you go to the YouTube channel for Glucksman Ireland House, you'll be actually able to watch back the lectures as well. It's an important moment, and the importance of it is signified by, for example, the participation of the head of the Irish government, the Irish Prime Minister, Taoiseach Micheál Martin. So it's my pleasure to share this with you today, folks. Enjoy. You learn lots. I certainly did. And we'll open up with An Taoiseach, then Provost Catherine Fleming, and then into Professor Jane Allmeyer.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be part of your conference today. For almost three decades, Glucksman Ireland House and New York University have promoted the study of Irish and Irish American history, heritage and culture in the United States and beyond. Ireland has a vibrant diaspora in the United States, which we greatly value. We know that the experiences and contribution of our diaspora are interwoven in the story of the United States over many generations. We also know that it is a richer, more diverse diaspora than has often been acknowledged, and that it has interacted and shared historical space with other communities and groups, all strands in the rich tapestry that is today's United States. All have lived with and influenced each other. Rather than a single history, the story of Irish America, of the Irish in America, and of the connections between Ireland and America is a complex one. Those histories have many dimensions to be celebrated, but equally other darker dimensions to be acknowledged and remembered. This conference reflects an emerging and growing interest both in academia and in the community in exploring in particular the overlapping histories and identities of those of Irish and African heritage and of those who share both. It is important work. There are many difficult aspects of Irish history, aspects of our relationship with Britain, the story of the two identities that share our island, how the country has sometimes been a cold and a hard place for women. As the Queen said so memorably during her historic visit to Ireland, with the benefit of historical hindsight, we can all see things which we would wish had been done differently or not at all. But we have learned that to understand who we are as a people, it is necessary to shine a light on all parts of our history, however painful, to explore and study it carefully, thoughtfully, and respectfully, and ultimately to come to terms with it and to remember it. In that context, I welcome this conference and the rich academic and community work you are part of. I appreciate and regret that it has sometimes been difficult for people to reconcile the different parts of their identities, being able to celebrate their Irishness while retaining rightful pride in their black or brown heritage. That should never be the case, but I understand why it has been so. The issues you are exploring today can help us to find ways to reconcile and to value those histories. It is important work, both where you are in the United States and where I am here in Ireland. Ireland is now a more diverse place, home to people from all parts of the world who are contributing to and shaping the country we are today. Working for an inclusive, diverse Ireland is supported by better understanding of the diversity of our diaspora and the role that Irish people of all backgrounds have played in the world. Last year, the government launched a new diaspora strategy, one that aims to celebrate our diversity. The Irish never were a homogenous group, and identity is never static. As a government, we want to be in constant conversation with our diaspora, and we are enriched by the distinct learnings and experiences they share. The launch of the African American Irish Diaspora Network in New York last year was therefore especially welcome. Ireland marked the centenary of Irish women's suffrage in 2018 with a poem from that great and much missed Irish poet, Evan Boland. Its title, "Our Future Will Become the Past of Other Women," reminds us that each generation creates a story and a legacy that it will pass to the next. What we do today shapes the future we will leave to future generations. And that is why the government in Ireland is working to build a truly inclusive Ireland, one that embraces all of our people, including those most recently arrived. We are working to tackle racism, including through a national action plan against racism being drafted by a national anti-racism committee, an independent committee that includes the voices of those with lived experience of racism. We are developing legislation to address hate crime, both offline and online. We are developing a migrant integration strategy to learn from the experiences of second and third generation young people, celebrating and respecting both the heritages of their families and their experiences as Irish people. Creating a better understanding of our shared history is vital to the task of shaping our future. In her poem, Evan Boland spoke to the countless forgotten women who worked to achieve female suffrage, including those with palms roughened by pulling a crop out of the earth, by lifting a cauldron off the hearth. She calls on them to remind us now, again, that history changes in one moment, with one mind, that it belongs to us, to all of us. And she promises them, "We will not leave you behind. History belongs to all of us, just as the future we will create together belongs to all of us. I wish you well in your discussions today and throughout the rest of the sessions. I'm genuinely hopeful that we can lay the foundations for action to create a better Ireland and a better Irish America where all can belong. Thank you very much indeed.
It's my privilege and honor to be able to introduce you to NYU's provost to help open the session. Catherine Fleming, provost of NYU, is the Alexander S. Onassis Professor of Hellenic Culture and Civilization in the Department of History. She also served for many years as Associate Director and then Director of NYU's Remarque Institute. A specialist on the religious history of Greece and the broader Mediterranean, she holds honorary doctorates from the University of Macedonia and from Ionian University in Greece. And her work has won the Runciman Prize and the National Jewish Book Award, among other honors. In 2019, she was nominated Chevalier in the French Legion of Honor. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you so much. And it's wonderful to be here with you this morning as provost and as a historian who's really interested in the kinds of questions that you're going to be considering. I want to welcome you and thank you very much for joining us for the kickoff of this important conference. I know we're all zoomed out, but this one is worth it, I assure you. And the fact that the head of the Irish government, Taoiseach Micheál Martin TD, has joined and given us that really interesting message, I think speaks volumes about the seriousness with which Ireland, I'm now supposed to say like NYU, but I'm embarrassed to compare NYU to a major nation, but the seriousness with which many of us in institutional and personal and national guises are reflecting in these really difficult times on matters of social justice and racial equality. And one of the things that's really striking about the speech that we just heard from Taoiseach Micheál Martin TD is that it really reflects a sense of maturity. From a historian's perspective, a mature nation is one that is able to reflect in serious ways upon the least happy and most difficult aspects of its history. And I'm very, very happy to see the bravery with which that project is being undertaken today. NYU itself is really committed to building and strengthening a university-wide culture of diversity and inclusion and equity. We also are trying to confront things in our past about which we are not so proud. We're engaging in consultation, resources, innovative strategies to help guide the university and its uniquely global and diverse student, faculty, staff, administration, and alumni communities to lead them all to a more inclusive future. And I personally am really, really delighted to see Glucksman Ireland House and the Gallatin School of Individualized Study take this opportunity, the opportunity of this conference, to engage in these vital conversations, for which thank you very, very much. The Black, Brown, and Green Voices Project is important and timely, and I really commend everyone involved in its inception and innovative execution. As someone whose own family name, Fleming, was given to us in the 12th century in the wake of invasions of Ireland by the Irish, I have spent a certain amount of time considering the ways in which I myself can and cannot lay claim to the histories that we're talking about today. So also on a personal note, I'm very pleased and interested by this work. But I am even more pleased to be introducing the first speaker of today's conference, the awesomely impressive Professor Jane Ohlmeyer, who is joining us from Dublin. Professor Jane Ohlmeyer, M-R-I-A, F-T-C-D, F-R-H-S. If you don't know the meaning of those acronyms, shame on you. She is the Erasmus Smith's Professor of Modern History, 1762, at Trinity College Dublin, and was a huge driving force behind the 1641 Depositions Project, about which I encourage you all to learn more. The development of the Trinity Long Room Hub Arts and Humanities Research Institute, and also the principal investigator or co-PI for over 20 competitive grants. That's just prodigiously productive. Since 2015, Professor Ohlmeyer has been chair of the Irish Research Council, an agency that funds frontier research across all disciplines. She's the author or editor of numerous articles and a staggering 11 books, including being the editor of Volume 2 of The Cambridge History of Ireland, which was published in 2018. And she's currently working on a book on colonial Ireland, colonial India, which she first presented as the Ford Lectures in Oxford 2021. So, Professor Ohlmeyer, welcome. I'm sorry we can't welcome you to the literal New York, but we welcome you to the spiritual New York, and thank you so much for joining our event.
Thank you very much, Provost Fleming, for that really warm welcome, and hello, everybody. Needless to say, I'd love to be there in person, but anyway, it's lovely that Zoom brings us together today. I do want to thank Miriam and Kim, though, for this invitation to speak and for organizing this wonderful conference. It's really exciting. You're leading such important work there at NYU under the auspices of the Black, Brown and Green Project. And congratulations to you. I also really welcome the Black and Irish Initiative, and well done to Kieran Madden. I was going to say, formerly of your parish and now of mine for the leadership Kieran and others have shown. So I come to this conversation as a historian of early modern Ireland and empire. My real center of gravity is the 17th century, and as the Provost has just outlined, part of it does actually draw on the Ford Lectures that I gave virtually in Oxford back in the spring, entitled Ireland, Empire and the Early Modern World, which are, if anybody's interested, happen to be on the RTE website. So it's very much coming from that place. I've got some slides, and Dave has very kindly agreed to show them for me, Dave. So I'm going to invite you, if you wouldn't mind, to put the slides up for us, and hopefully we're not going to have any issues. I'm going to begin this lecture by sharing with you in a moment an image by the incredible Irish artist, a woman called Rita Duffy, who was the creative practitioner in residence at the Trinity Long Room Hub, where until recently I served as director. And over the course of the last few years, I've had the privilege of getting to know Rita, who incidentally I think is, she may even be in the Zoom room, but I know she's heading to New York in the morning. Rita's work is all about identity, and much of it responds to colonialism. So we've much in common, aside from a shared experience of growing up in Belfast together during the Troubles. So first slide, please, Dave. So the picture that you see there is something that will be very familiar to many of you. On the 6th of January 2021, the Feast of the Epiphany, hence the name of the painting, a crazed mob of extremists, egged on by a sitting president, attacked the U.S. Capitol building, the symbol of American democracy. Rita captures the horror of the moment and the trauma of the preceding months, which of course were compounded by the pandemic. On the left, or on my left, a sinister group of white supremacists, lorded over by a naked Donald Trump, loudly and aggressively celebrate their power. As we know, Trump supporters, including those of Irish origin who selectively use their Irish history to justify their racism. On the right, Rita visualizes the tragedy of black slavery and the ongoing inequality and persecution. As we look at this painting, we need to remember that at least 30% of African Americans of Irish heritage will find their roots in dark places, and no doubt that figure would be higher if we included the Caribbean. Here Rita invites us to reflect on what whiteness, blackness, and Irishness mean today? While the dominant image of the covered wagon and the incarcerated black figures invite discussions of colonialism and slavery, the campaigns around Black Lives Matter and Statues Must Fall are also so powerfully depicted here in Rita's painting, and I'm very conscious of the current charged political context in which our discussions are taking place. Next slide, please. The movements associated with Black Lives Matter and Statues Must Fall and the related culture wars have very specific contexts in the US and the UK, but have also found their mark in Ireland. In May 2022, there was an unprecedented response to George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, but this became even more poignant after the death of George Sinclenko in Clonie, Ireland in December 2020. So, as the Taoiseach reminded us, as we begin to confront racism in Ireland, we have also been debating how we might decolonise Irish history and engage with colonial legacies in our universities and cultural institutions. Next slide, please. There have been heated public and academic discussions, including a powerful reflection on empire by President Higgins. We've been debating empire and decolonisation in our summer schools, classrooms and in public fora. An opinion piece I published in the Irish Times back in December generated comment. Many people contacted me with stories of being born in India, Hong Kong or Africa, and with tales of a family member who worked in colonial service as administrators, teachers, healthcare workers, nuns, priests or soldiers. But there was also a mini storm on Twitter with a small and anonymous group of racist extremists launching toxic attacks. All of this demonstrated to me that our history, so core to our identity, really does matter. Like it or not, empire, colonialism and race has profoundly shaped us as it shaped people from Ireland living in the early modern world. And it's now back into the 17th century. I'm going to drag you. Next slide, please. But given the importance of this topic, it's remarkable how little is written about it. There are, of course, a number of notable exceptions. Particularly important is the pioneering research of Aubrey Gwynne, dating from the 1930s, Hilary Beckles and Meanie Rogers. Though Hilary Beckles, and I'm very much hoping that, you know, you'll be hearing from him over the course of the next few weeks, he's primarily a historian of the West Indies, where his research on slavery and gender is inspiring. But his work on the Irish as indentured servants and free people in the Caribbean, published in the 1990s, really broke new ground and drew attention to fresh archives. And it, along with Meanie Rogers' fabulous monograph, Ireland Slavery and Anti-Slavery, which was published in 2007, paved the way for a fresh wave of research and a whole new generation of historians. And this talk owes much to these remarkable scholars established, but also this new wave. Next slide, please. So over the course of the next 25, 30 minutes or so, I want to do three things. I want to say something about race and othering in early modern Ireland. I want to talk about slavery and the Irish. And I then want to reflect on indentured service and the slave trade in the Caribbean. So let's start with race and othering. At the outset, I need to issue a health warning. Race, as we understand it today, cannot be transposed to early modern Ireland, where the context was very different. Equally, we have to be cautious about transferring across time pre-modern ideologies of ethnic superiority and equating those with modern notions of racism. While there are some striking continuities, and obviously I'll touch on those, it really was the 19th century before modern racial ideology was born. All of that said, a discourse of civility and barbarism, grounded in a shared understanding of the philosophical writings of Aristotle and Cicero, had long underpinned English imperialism in Ireland. The fact that the political and social organisation, the culture and the economic practices of Ireland did not coincide with the norms of English society left it open for scorn and led to comparisons with the ancient Britons, whom the Romans had civilised, or with the Amerindians of the New World, or the infidel or pagan Turks to the east. Next slide, please. Giraldus Cambrensis, also known as Gerald of Wales, writing from a classical perspective in the 12th century, consistently referred to the Irish as a barbarous people, a rude people with primitive habits, living themselves like beasts. In his description of the character and customs and habits of the Irish in his Topographia, Cambrensis argued that Ireland's geographical isolation from the civilized nations ensured, and I'm quoting here, that they learn nothing and practice nothing but the barbarism in which they are born and bred and which sticks to them like a second nature. Cambrensis, I just want to say a word about it because it became a bestseller across Europe where the lingua franca of the intelligentsia remained Latin. And then an English translation of his work was published in another bestseller, Holinshed's Chronicles. And this ensured that the early modern readers appropriated this medieval rhetoric, denigrating everything Irish, promoting everything English. However, the fundamental belief of these humanist writers was that the Irish were capable of reform. And over time, their views became subsumed by a generation of apocalyptic historians, as Nicholas Canny has termed them in his latest book, Imagining Ireland's Past. And if you haven't read it, I encourage you to. It's really tremendous. Next slide, please. What began as an ideology of cultural difference soon turned into one of cultural superiority. The apocalyptic historians included John Derrick. In his Image of Ireland, Derrick reinforced in prose and with graphic woodcuts negative images of the Irish and branded them as animals, as subhuman, as grasshoppers and caterpillars, as hogs and dogs. Here is the woodcut of the woodquern, wearing a much vilified mantle with wolves in the background. These ethnocentric ideas, of course, also permeated the English colonies in the New World, something I'll return to. Next slide, please. Back in Ireland, though, the classic exponent of superiority during these years was the poet and planter Edmund Spenser, who, in a view of the state of Ireland, called for the wholesale destruction of the Irish, along with their culture, society and economy, and invited England to enjoy a monopoly over the exercise of violence. Having purged Ireland of its Irishness, the country would then be colonised with English settlers responsible for the erection of the political, economic and social framework that was considered the necessary support of a civil life in a Protestant faith. Next slide, please. Spenser's view became a foundational text, just as the writings of Giraldus Cambrensis had in an earlier period, and influenced policymakers from the 17th century well into the 19th century, where it fed into a wider discourse of race and of othering across Asia and Africa. And I think these cartoons from the 1880s illustrate this progression. On the left, you see, obviously, the Victorians regarded the Irish Celt as a distinct race and represented an Irish man here as a chimpanzee. In the middle is a drawing entitled Imperial Problems, where you see an Irish terrorist with a black monkey-like face alongside an African warrior. And then on the far right, the cartoonist shows emancipated slaves in the South carrying as much political weight as the sluggish Simeon-like Irish in the north. This brings me to the second theme I'd like to explore here, slavery and the Irish. Next slide, please. As the example of the young St. Patrick illustrates, chattel slavery, especially of women, had been common in early medieval Ireland, and it really only died out in the 12th century with the rise of serfdom. In the early modern period, there are examples of Irish people being enslaved after being captured by Barbary pirates. However, if ransoms were paid, the captives were released. For example, in 1646, 19 Irish women were redeemed from slavery in Algiers. Six came from Youghal. Two others, Ellen Hawkins and Joan Brabrook, had been seized 15 years earlier from Baltimore in West Cork, when in 1631, Barbary pirates had sacked the town and made captive at least 100 people. And you see this slide here, this wonderful map of Baltimore dating from the 1630s. Now, of course, others were not ransomed and appear to have lived out their lives as slaves, unless they converted to Islam or escaped. Next slide, please. I want to turn to early modern discussions of political slavery, because for generations, Irish writers have used the metaphor of slavery to voice their opposition to English imperial rule and to colonialism. According to a later account, Rory O'Moore, who's one of the leaders of the 1641 rebellion that triggered an onset of civil war in Ireland during the 1640s, O'Moore complained that the Irish Catholics were forced to choose either slavery in this world because they were excluded from political life or eternal damnation in the next. The anonymous author of a collection entitled The Lights of the Blind, written at the turn of the 18th century, wrote, quote, the Irish are treated by the ruling powers not as subjects, but in the quality of slaves, that an ancient noble nation is this enslaved for to support a main colony therein planted by the regicide sword of Cromwell. Next slide, please. In a similar vein, though coming from a very different place, William Molyneux, Jonathan Swift, and other Protestants, no doubt influenced by John Locke, argued that Albion had enslaved Hibernia and that a free society must appoint its own government. Of course, this excluded the Catholics, who, according to Molyneux, could not be free humans because they chose to obey the Pope. Next slide, please. From the later 17th century, explicit comparisons were made between Irish Catholics and African enslaved people. Sir William Petty, for example, suggested that the economic value of Irishmen be assessed, quoting here, as slaves and Negroes are usually rated, with men at £25 and children at £5. By contrast, an Englishman was valued at £70. In the early 1720s, George Barclay, the renowned Irish philosopher himself an owner of slaves on his Rhode Island plantation, wrote, quote, if Negro was not Negro, Irishman would be Negro. Next slide, please. Very occasionally, there are references to black slaves in 17th century Ireland. In St. Mary's Church in Yall, the baptism is recorded in 1666 of David, formerly known as Lampo. And then I'm quoting, a Negro aged 15 years or thereabouts, born in Montserrat, one of the Caribbean islands. In this image, you see Lady Arran being waked in Dublin in 1669. And you can see a black servant in the bottom right-hand corner. Other evidence tells us that there was a black servant called Scipio at Kilkenny Castle in the service of Elizabeth, Duchess of Ormond, who may well be represented here since the Duchess was the chief mourner at her daughter-in-law's funeral. Now, aside from these fleeting references to Scipio and Lampo, they're lost from the records. However, Bill Hart has suggested and estimated that by the second half of the 18th century, between 1,000 and 2,000 black people, mostly male domestic servants and probably slaves, lived scattered through the eastern half of Ireland, but were predominantly in Dublin and Munster. I want to turn now to the final and third part of my paper, where I look at indentured service and the slave trade in the Caribbean. Next slide, please. By 1660, Irish people were to be found in the French and Danish West Indies, the Portuguese and later Dutch Amazon, Spanish Mexico and Cuba, and in the English settlements in North America, the Caribbean, India and the Mediterranean. At sea, the Irish served in royal navies or as pirates and privateers. On land, they joined colonial settlements, forged commercial networks and served as administrators, soldiers, educators, priests and preachers. But for the rest of my talk, I want to focus on those who profited from trafficking in human cargoes, servants and slaves, and from trading tobacco and sugar, the successful cultivation of which depended on the labour of indentured servants and enslaved Africans. Next slide, please. This trade, at least in the English Atlantic Empire, was bankrolled by a group of merchant adventurers, or venture capitalists as we know them today, who used Irish land to fuel their global expansionism, including the slave trade. Now, David Brown's pioneering research has made visible this group of roughly 20 men led by Maurice Thompson. And if you haven't read his book, I really urge you to, because he shows how they exchanged slaves for Spanish silver and sugar from the Caribbean. They then used the silver to buy Indian textiles, which could in turn be exchanged in Africa for more enslaved people. And these merchant adventurers, primarily in London, but also in Amsterdam, had very close links to influential Protestant entrepreneurs. Next slide. Like these people. So this is Richard Boyle, Earl of Cork, and Arthur Ainslie, Earl of Anglesey. And I just use these two as an example, because a very complex web of relationships embedded the Earl of Cork in the English imperial system, especially the tobacco trade, which boomed during the 1620s and 30s, along with the trade of indentured servants. A little bit later, the Earl of Anglesey was a major figure in Restoration Ireland and England, and his daughter married John Thompson, son of Maurice. And as the entries in Anglesey's diary record, he regularly attended meetings of the Gambia Company at the Committee of Trade and Plantations, or with commissioners from New England and Tangiers. And he regularly entertained other entrepreneurs, including those from Ireland, who shared his imperial business interests. Next slide, please. Irish engagement with human trafficking began in the early 17th century with indentured servants. The investor covered the cost of the passage and food, the clothing, the shelter on the plantations in return for up to 7 years of contracted labour. It was 10 in the case of convicts. On termination of the indenture, masters were legally bound to offer freedom dues in the form of a small parcel of land, a sum of money, or commodities that were equivalent. Unlike the enslaved person, the indentured servant had some legal rights, even if it proved challenging to exercise them. And you can see in front of you an indenture dating from 1739 for an Irish orphan, Patrick Burke, which lays out the terms and conditions of his 4 years of service as a bookkeeper in Jamaica. Now, I've not managed to actually see any earlier ones, and I'm hoping that somebody in the Zoom room might have seen some of these actual indentures dating from the 17th century. Undoubtedly, though, the process was much better structured in this later period than the earlier one. Next slide, please. However, during the period of indenture, the person was like an enslaved person at the mercy of their master. Richard Ligon, who wrote A History of Barbados, first published in 1657, distinguished between the categories of servitude. And I'm quoting here, "The slaves and their posterity being subject to their masters forever are kept and preserved with greater care than the servants, who are theirs but for 5 years." Ligon described the life of an indentured servant, their basic housing, clothing and diet, along with the long and hard working day and the punishments they received. I'm quoting again, "Truly, I have seen such cruelty done done to servants as I did not think one Christian could have done to another." Of course, experiences did vary, and according to Richard Dunn in Sugar and Slaves, indentured servants were better fed, clothed and housed than enslaved people. From the early decades of the 17th century, indentured men and women left Ireland in significant numbers, destined primarily for the Caribbean. Roughly one third were women, about whom we know very little, despite, as Hilary Beckles reminds us, of their importance for the labour market. The rest were men, mostly under the age of 25, who were from the lowest social economic sector of society, typically unskilled or semi-skilled servants or vagrants. As the sugar rush gained momentum, this trafficking of humans increased, and during the 1650s, the Cromwellian authorities shipped thousands of Irish Catholics directly to English colonies in the Caribbean. Others were traded at the Dutch slave market at Pernambuco, which would be modern day Recife in northeast Brazil. And there an indentured man from Ireland could be sold for between 10 and 13 pounds, which was half the cost of an enslaved man from Africa. Next slide, please. It's important to remember that more African slaves were shipped to Brazil than anywhere else, and probably the first Irish owner of enslaved Africans in Brazil was Bernardo O'Brien, along with other Catholics from County Clare, who worked as tobacco and timber merchants in the Dutch Amazon during the early decades of the 17th century. This incredible image from 1641 of an idealized slave in Brazil wearing an Indian cotton skirt with a Dutch pipe at her waist is by the Dutch painter Albert Eckhout, the originals in Copenhagen. Now, of course, this picture disguises the grim reality and the sheer horror and inhumanity of slavery. Though profoundly ethnocentric, Richard Ligon, his History of Barbados, nonetheless captured the harshness and brutality of the daily lives of enslaved people. His chilling account of planters purchasing naked slaves, quote, as they do horses in a market, is matched by vivid ethnographic descriptions of the harsh experiences of enslaved peoples in the sugar plantations, along with their customs, communities and practices, and their sufferings from disease, diet, and at the hands of brutal masters and overseers who were invariably white and sometimes Irish. Next slide, please. The County Down doctor, collector and naturalist Hans Sloane, who travelled to the Caribbean in the 1680s, described the punishments meted out to slaves. Those who rebelled were burned by degrees. The punishments for lesser crimes ranged from gelding, chopping off half a foot, placing iron rings on ankles and necks, and vicious beatings. Then the master rubbed into raw wounds, and I'm quoting, pepper and salt to make them smart, or dropped, again quoting, melted wax on their skins. Sloane described the arrival of a slave ship from the Gold Coast, which he wrote was, quote, very nasty with so many people on board. Next slide, please. What is not described is the trauma the person had also experienced on the foot of their capture in Africa, nor of the horrendous conditions they had endured in the voyage, roughly 50 days across the Atlantic. During the 1680s, over 20% of the enslaved people died on the Middle Passage. The death rate was reduced to 10% by the early 18th century. Most slaves that crossed the Atlantic originated on the Gold Coast, but a few years ago, I visited the former slave market in Zanzibar, which was the centre of the slave trade in East Africa, and it was a chilling experience to see the cramped and unsanitary conditions in which slaves were incarcerated, sometimes for months prior to being shipped. Next slide, please. In 1789, Thomas Clarkson began to collect materials for the anti-slavery campaign, and he commissioned and circulated this now iconic drawing of the Brooks of Liverpool, a vessel capable of carrying 600 slaves. The dehumanizing precision with which shackled slaves were arranged shocked contemporaries, as it continues to shock anyone who sees it. But we need to note that for a time, a Munster man, Clement Noble from Ardmore, was captain of the Brook. Though the Royal Africa Company, established in 1660, banned Irish merchants from trading directly in enslaved people, a handful did, especially via Bristol. And Richard Dunn has estimated that between 1640 and 1700, 263,000 slaves landed in the English Sugar Islands. And then, of course, these numbers just escalated in the 18th century. During the early decades, the Royal Africa Company shipped about 600,000 people to the Caribbean and Brazil, and an additional 300,000 to Spanish America. Irish people benefited indirectly thus from the slave trade as captains, Captain Noble, or as sailors. The Munster rural economy and the Port of Cork boomed as farmers and entrepreneurs exported to the Caribbean barrelled butter, salt beef, herrings and other goods. Finally, Irish people owned and traded slaves, especially on sugar plantations in the Caribbean, where according to Dunn, sugar planters created one, I'm quoting here, one of the harshest systems of servitude in Western history. One of the most successful Irish slavers was Antoine Walsh, the son of a Dublin merchant who settled in France in the later 17th century. And over the course of his career, Walsh, who was based in the Atlantic port of Nantes, made 40 slaving trips and shipped over 12,000 enslaved Africans. Next slide, please. With his profits, Walsh purchased a plantation for himself in the French colony of Saint-Domingue at modern-day Haiti, which supplied 70% of all sugar to France. The Irish also formed communities there, as they did in St. Kitts, which was half-owned with the English, in Guadeloupe and Martinique. Irish priests periodically visited the islands and reported back. There are 200 Irish in Martinique, 800 in Guadeloupe. Only the very few prospered. The majority eked out existences in the remotest parts of the islands. In return for religious toleration and access to land, Catholic Irishmen helped to develop sugar and slavery in the Danish Empire. And here Orla Power's research has illuminated the Irish presence on the Danish island of St. Croix, where Nicholas Chute, formerly of Montserrat, owned 7 plantations and was part owner of 7 more, all geared for sugar production. And by the mid-18th century, the Irish community of St. Croix numbered 250 people, along with 22,000 slaves. And today the landscape of St. Croix bears the names of Irish estates: Enfield Bog, Bog of Allen, Butler's Bay, Castle Burke, and so on. Next slide, please. But this was also the case in the English Caribbean, where the landscapes of the Leeward Islands, especially Montserrat, bear witness to the early Irish settlers. In 1639, there were some 3,000 Irish Catholics living on the Leeward Islands, and one of them was one of the most successful was William Stapleton, the Catholic Tipperary-born governor, who conducted this remarkable census in 1678 and provides a wonderful snapshot of the Irish on the islands of Nevis, Antigua, St. Kitts and Montserrat. And across the Leewards, there were 10,408 whites, over a third of whom were Irish. A census, interestingly, 30 years later, shows how the white population had dropped by roughly a third, but the black population had increased hugely, over threefold. Next slide, please. The Jamaica census of 1673 shows that the black population was greater, but only by a small margin. And after 1692, William O'Brien, 2nd Earl of Inchiquin, who in 1660 had been captured himself by Algerian pirates, but went on to become a slave trader, briefly lorded it there over the 700-odd property owners, about 10% of whom were of Irish extraction. The majority of Irish people, though, were poor, relegated to marginal areas in the interior, and they were perceived to be unruly and disloyal to the English, but of course loyal to the French, and so the authorities were very suspicious of them and monitored them closely, as they did those in Barbados. Next slide, please. Barbados was the big sugar producer, and 60 to 70% of all sugar from the Caribbean was came from Barbados, and it was the destination for the Cromwellian transplantees during the 1650s. A Catholic priest, John Grace, estimated in 1669 there's a community of 8,000 Irish there, which, if accurate, would have meant that the Irish comprised nearly half of the white population on the island. But the Catholicism of the Irish, their poverty and their propensity for rebellion reinforced their subordinate status. And according to Hilary Beckles, and I'm quoting Beckles here, Irish servants and freemen suffered the most intense day-to-day discrimination and humiliation on the labour market. They were kept in slave-like conditions and rarely given employment that conferred prestige. So in short, English masters really considered Irish servants to belonging to a backward culture and were unfit to do anything except contribute their labour. Over time, their whiteness did accord the Irish some advantage, even if their poverty rendered them contemptible. And a single example illustrates this. Cornelius Bryan, who had arrived in the 1650s and invoked the ire of the authorities, had by 1680 acquired a modest estate of 22 acres in St. James's Parish in Barbados. He died 7 years later, leaving a feather bed, a cedar chest, a black horse, and 13 slaves. Next slide, please. After Barbados, the greatest number of Irish people lived in Montserrat, which was described in 1634 as, quote, a noble plantation of Irish Catholics, and in 1668 as, quote, almost an Irish colony. During Stapleton's tenure as governor, Irish Catholics, mostly from Connacht and from Munster, represented 69% of the white population in Montserrat, and they rose to positions as elected assemblymen and came to hold numerous positions of importance. merchants like Henry Blake of Galway amassed small fortunes, often on the back of sugar produced by enslaved Africans. And by 1729, the majority of the 5,855 slaves on Montserrat were owned by Irish families, the Farrells, Husseys, Lynches, Roaches, and others. So what did all of this mean for their identity? Irish Catholics like Stapleton and his associates in the Leeward Islands used every opportunity, especially marriage, education and social interactions, to make themselves English without compromising their Catholicism. Nicholas Chute may have made his fortune on the Danish colony of St. Croix, but he was quick to settle in London, as was Thomas Ryan from Montserrat, and by 1750 the upwardly mobile Ryan had made enough money to move his family to London, send his boys to English boarding schools, and marry off his daughter to a prosperous English recusant family. Writing in 1655, Henry Cromwell, son of Oliver, who had served as the governor of Ireland in the 50s, maintained that the transportations of Irish to the West Indies would, and I'm quoting here, turn them into Englishmen. This was clearly the case with the Ryans, Chutes and Stapletons, but what of the poor Irish, known as the Redlegs, whose loyalty was always regarded with suspicion, or those of mixed heritage born to enslaved mothers? Here the records are apparently silent, though we can draw inspiration from the pioneering work of Marissa Fuentes, who in Dispossessed Lives offers vivid insights into the lives of enslaved women in Barbados, or that of Jenny Shaw, who uses legal and other disparate records to recover the lives of Susanna Mingo and the children she bore to a wealthy and influential slave master, John Pierce, in Barbados in the 1670s and 80s. In other words, I think there's tremendous opportunity to look again at all of this. And I just want to draw things together by bringing us back to early modern Ireland. Please, next slide. Because, as is well known, the lucky few, the profits made from sugar and tobacco proved transformational. Grants from tobacco duties over the early 18th century funded improvements to Trinity College Dublin, including the construction of the West Front, which you see here. Wealthy Protestant planters from the Caribbean purchased country estates or renovated existing properties. For example, the Browns of Westport in Mayo, or Fionnuala O'Kane's work has recovered the stories of the Lutetias of Rathfarnham and Jamaica. Next slide, please. Historians, thanks in part to the work of archaeologists, are really coming to better appreciate how products associated with enslaved peoples, especially sugar and tobacco, shaped lives in England. But I think we have to wonder if Irish consumers of tobacco and sugar really associated them with the enslavement of African people. Next slide, please. I began this talk with a painting by Rita Duffy that invites us to reflect on Irishness, whiteness, blackness and slavery. And I want to close with a 17th century novel by another remarkable woman who aspired to do something similar. And it's Aphra Behn's Orinoco, the Royal Slave, which was published in 1688, the year before she died. And it presents a remarkably insightful and provocative account of slavery and plantation in the early modern world, even if her focus is on the individual tragedy of an African prince rather than the practice of slavery. Hers is the story of Orinoco and Imoinda, the beautiful Black Venus and a great love of Orinoco's life. Orinoco's grandfather, the king of Coromantén, sells Imoinda into slavery shortly afterwards. English traders also enslave Orinoco himself. He is shipped to Suriname, then an English and later a Dutch colony on the northeast tip of Latin America, where he meets the narrator of the novel, who is the daughter of Suriname's governor Bynum, and is serendipitously reunited with Imoinda. Next slide, please. Now, it's widely believed that the royalist Aphra Behn had visited Suriname, a colony of about 800 white settlers, 2,500 African slaves and 500 Indian slaves, and that Behn witnessed firsthand the sugar plantations that depended on slave labor. And you can see here a map from 1667 showing all of the plantations. So even though Arnoko is, of course, a work of fiction, it has been suggested that the novel is based on real events and people, including William Bynum, and you see Bynum's point on the map. Certainly, Ben borrows from a variety of contemporary travel narratives, using to great effect ethnographic descriptions and graphic details, such as pepper being rubbed into Orinoco's wounds after he's been whipped. The novel ends when Orinoco, or Caesar, as he's now known, leads a rebellion of the African and Indian slaves. But a wild Irishman, and I'm quoting here, called Bannister, is the one who then kills Orinoco by burning him alive, having brutally dismembered him, first his nose and ears, then his arms and so on. Now, this is probably a reference to Major James Bannister, a thuggish figure who was responsible after 1667, when the Dutch took over, for evacuating the English colonists and resettling them in Jamaica, where he secured an estate of 3,000 acres, only to be murdered in 1672. That Ben calls him a wild Irishman is interesting, since other sources are silent on his background, even though we know that the Irish settled in the region. Remember Bernardo O'Brien. In a fascinating article, the literary scholar Lee Morrissey seizes on this mention of Bannister to situate Orinoco's life in the context of colonial Ireland and to link his violent death to the execution of Charles I. Bannister is both a wild Irishman and a Protestant merchant adventurer. Moreover, Bannister is white, something Orinoco calls out with his dying breath. Next slide, please. For the narrator and for Afroben herself, Orinoco was not a rebellious slave, but a handsome hero of great wit, learning, courage and honour. And this is picked up by the Dublin dramatist and Trinity student Thomas Southern, when in 1696 he transformed Ben's Orinoco into a popular tragedy. The plot was broadly in line with Ben's novel, except that Imoinda was white, and the play ends with Orinoco, not a wild Irishman, killing himself and his pregnant wife. The play was a huge hit in London and in Dublin, where there were regular performances, sometimes annual performances, from 1699 right through until the late 1750s. Thus, Orinoco's strong anti-slavery message helped generations to question slavery decades before abolitionism took hold. It also fell to an Irish playwright to celebrate the marriage, intimacy and love of a white woman and a black man. Given how rare these sorts of unions would have been, no doubt Southern sought to fire imaginations. That Southern conveniently removed Bannister and thus downplayed the aggressive colonialism and ethnocentricity he stood for is also intriguing in what it had to say about Irishness. Thank you very much for your attention, and apologies if I've gone on, but thank you for your listening.
We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life, and thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.